Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020 for the last time, because this is the final stream. And I'm here with James Alsop. James Alsop needs no introduction, of course, but nonetheless, James, how would you describe yourself to anyone who somehow hasn't heard of you?
Well, a former YouTuber, I think, would be the first.
Recovering YouTuber.
Well, in 2019, because we did this last year, in 2019, I would say recovering, because it was still, that was only a few months after the channel had been deleted. You know, I was deleted around 450,000 subs. But at this point, I would say fully recovered. I think it's actually a very liberating feeling to no longer have to. And, you know, of course, we are doing this on YouTube, and so we're all aware of the limitations and what can and cannot be said on YouTube. But it's very, I would say, liberating to not have to be policing yourself in that way anymore in the content that you do. And that also has a downstream effect of changing the way you think generally. I mean, when you're doing content, when you're writing a script for a video, when you're doing research and deciding what information to include, what not to include, what to say, what not to say, and you think you're doing this just for the presentation, after long enough, and you're convinced at the same time that you are, you know, subliminally seeding some message in there, or that everybody's getting what you're saying really, and that everybody's picking up on what you're laying down. But what I found is that oftentimes you're not only lying to your audience, but you're lying to yourself. And the limitations we impose on ourselves, and these are not limitations we like to impose on ourselves. These are limitations that come at the behest of the Anti-Defamation League and groups such as that. With what we can say online, it changes how we think, and we become convinced that we're putting out a very effective and very powerful message, when in reality we're not, because we can't touch those third rails. We can't push on those boundaries.
Yeah, we've been muted.
Yeah, but at the same time, it has a very pernicious effect of convincing you that actually you are on the bleeding edge. And this is not to begrudge anybody that does this. I understand people. YouTube is a livelihood. It's a business for many people. It was for me before I lost that opportunity. And so I recognize people have to, you know, stay in their own lane and you know, decide what they're comfortable with and what they're not comfortable with. But I think, and what I've seen from a lot of people who have done that and who have managed to stay on platforms, is unfortunately that they then become so divorced from that third rail. They get so far away from that bleeding edge that their content becomes indiscernible from that of something you would see out of the Republican Party or Turning Point USA or the conservatives in the United Kingdom, for example, and you're not actually saying anything meaningful. So, yeah.
Yeah, that is that's a dilemma, isn't it? So for how to remain on YouTube or on any of the mainstream platforms whilst remaining interesting and honest with yourself and with your audience, and how can you say anything that's worth? I mean, for me, I always started that in the first place. My channel wasn't really it definitely wasn't supposed to be political. It wasn't intended political. It was about morals, psychology, culture. So I think I can migrate back to that and retain integrity. I hope so. I mean, that depends on my channel surviving. I don't know if it will, but if it does, then that's what I intend to do. But if your stuff has been explicitly political, and you're still being political, but you're just not saying anything of any worth, then yeah, it's kind of tragic. It's someone who's been castrated.
It is. And yeah, it's someone who, and again, this is not to begrudge anybody. People are looking out for themselves and doing what they need to do, and I totally understand that. But the effect that it has is convincing people, and you see this in internet dialectics too, and the optics debate generally, where people think, as long as we don't talk about certain topics, then we can continue to spread our message. But those important topics, like... really, it's talking about you know, those that are setting the parameters of debate, those that control the West. We know who these people are. If you can't talk about them, then you can't talk about anything important, because that is that key ingredient that you need to make everything else fall into place. It's It's the decoder ring. It's the cipher that you need to understand why everything happens as it does. Because without understanding that element, you can't understand why, for example, the United States in the COVID relief bill is giving another $500 billion to Israel. You can't understand these Middle East peace deals. You can't understand United States involvement in the Middle East generally.
Well, it also just doesn't make sense why a people in America or indeed in Europe would destroy themselves.
Right.
In multiple ways with mass immigration, dismantling their own culture and so on. Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is why so many people in the more alt-light side of things seem to just arrive at a point where they just say, it's all just madness. It's all just crazy.
Crazy, yeah.
Clown world.
These insane liberals. And so we were going to talk about 2020 retrospect. And one of the things that I am the most glad about in 2020 that has entered into this discourse, and this is something that we started talking about on my podcast, FTN, which you can find linked down below, I assume. We started talking about this phenomenon known as Finkelthink. And this is a frame of political debate that was pioneered by a strategist named Arthur Finkelstein in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And this is rejectionist voting. This is labeling the other candidate as too liberal, too crazy, too insane, and then getting people to vote for your candidate, not based on the merit of what that candidate will do, but based on how bad the other candidate is. And so this is the trap that a lot of people fall into. And this is something that people in 2020, a lot of people found themselves supporting Donald Trump again because they looked at the other side of the aisle and thought, well, things will be so much worse with the Democrats, so I have to vote Republican. And you need to understand that these are two sides of the same machine. And I know I hate the phrase two sides of the same coin. It's very overused. But this entire thing is a stage production. This is an act of theater where you are being given two seemingly different choices. But if you're missing that key element, who is really in power, who's really in control of this system, then you can't understand this. And like you were saying earlier, you can't understand why a people, why the British people, why the German people, why the American people who came into their own, developing this new American ethnicity, derived of European stock in the 1800s, why people like this, who had built, frankly, in terms of history, a stunning civilization, conquering the West, which was untamed by anybody else. We had done great things as a people. Why that people would then turn on itself, internalize this self-hatred, and enter into effectively a societal death cult wishing for its own destruction. If you can't understand, or if you are missing that key element, who injected that ideology into us, then you'll never understand why it's happening. And so, and exactly right, like with alt-light or with Republicans or whomever, the blame will always be deflected back to the Democrats or the Marxists or the communists or some other, any direction other than the real problem.
Well, I mean, what gets me is those commentators I won't even name names, but I have named them before, who pretend to be really hardcore and no-nonsense and honest. But then when it comes to why is this happening, they say, I've no idea. I just can't. It's just bizarre. It's just crazy. Doesn't make any sense. And, I've seen they get to stay on mainstream newspapers and they get interviewed on the BBC and so on, precisely because they affect, if you do a book called The Strange Death of Europe, then you're saying that the death of Europe is strange and baffling and just doesn't make any sense. But, that I think that in itself is dishonest. Mind you, I do think there's more to it than just what we're referring to. I think that there is some kind of psychological, there is a spiritual problem in European people, in white people. There is something that made us vulnerable in the first place. I think that we probably were on a downturn and, something happened. But, Let's go into 2020 then, because this is the topic that has dominated, because this year has been so so full of things. It's there's been no end of discussion about it on Millennial. What would you? I mean, what would you say are the highlights? Just before we go into them, what would you list as the really important events of this year?
Well, for me personally, and this gets back to the idea of making politics the omnipotent part of your life. The highlights of 2020 for me, if I were to list the top five or top 10, none of them would be political. I think the number one would be the birth of my second child this summer. Number two would be the first birthday of my first child this year. And so, you know, familial events that have happened to me have just been so much, filled me with so much more hope and excitement and pride than anything that's developed politically. But to talk about what's happened politically, I think that even though things seem, obviously things seem bleak for a lot of people, for a lot of reasons, I think one of the highlights, and this is going to be misconstrued, I know this already, but is seeing the amount of white men in particular in the United States who did not vote for Donald Trump the second time around. And look, there have been reports of voter fraud, some of them credulous, some of them not. This is not the place to litigate that. But the data is irrefutable that millions of white men that voted for Donald Trump in 2016 did not vote for Donald Trump in 2020. And this is good because this is showing, and this is proof, that people are not going to be placated with empty platitudes in American politics anymore. An increasing number of people are not going to be placated. And it takes us back to where we were, I think, in 2012 and 2013, when a lot of people were looking at the two-party system. We're looking at the Democrats with Obama. We're looking at the Republicans with Mitt Romney and saying, there's nothing here for me. There's nothing here for us. There's nothing here for my family. Pulling the lever for either side is not going to bring the jobs back to this country. It's not going to bring about an end to the opioid epidemic. It's not going to stop the invasion of our country. So why would I invest myself deeply in this electoral process at all? It's a very good question, very valid question. And I know there's been a lot of Twitter rancor about this 5%. And I think people are missing the point with a lot of that because people are saying, well, this is the 5% that voted for Joe Biden, that went from Trump to Joe Biden. That's not the case. What happened is people stayed home. People stayed home. People checked out of the electoral system. And it's a very important distinction to make between electoral system and political system because politics are still important. But elections, getting excited for next election, placing the hope for you, for your family, for your civilization in next election. I don't care which Western country you're in, whether it's the United States or Germany or the United Kingdom. That's not going to be the answer because these parties are constructed specifically to act as gatekeepers, to act as the boundaries and to act as filters, I guess would be a good term, to keep dangerous ideas out. To read what people are upset about and then to dilute that and mold that into an energy that is safe for the system. We see this in the United States very clearly. People who are upset about the United States, for example, giving industry to China, letting our jobs be taken by overseas players. This is then molded into, you know, we need to destroy the CCP. We need to get involved in bringing down communist China, which is not going to do anything for Americans to bring jobs back to America. Or in the UK is a great example in 2016, where people were rightly angry about foreigners coming into their country, about the loss of sovereignty, about London being a minority white city. And people thought Brexit would be the answer for this. But if you dug very closely into what Nigel Farage was saying, Farage, his immigration proposal post-Brexit, was to bring in more Commonwealth immigration.
Yeah, more people from outside Europe. So more non-white. I mean, it's like out of the frying pan into the fire, basically. You thought that this would be your salvation, but actually it's just a trap and it's going to make things even worse. I mean, there's more to it than that because I think it is good for Britain to have sovereignty away from Brussels, away from the EU. But globalism gets its way. Unless you directly attack that, then it will co-opt any other thing that you try to use.
And that's the problem that we have across the West, is the idea that we can sneak in some kind of meaningful populism, meaningful third positionism, you know, just attach that as like a rider onto something else and hijack some other entity or party to convince them to do what we want. But that's based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the purpose of these institutions and parties. These parties and institutions exist specifically to prevent that from happening. And so, yes, you know, Britain gaining sovereignty from the EU, definitely that's a good development. But I think the rub is going to be in it, what they do with that sovereignty, right? And who comes to power and how they utilize that sovereignty. Do they use it to bring jobs back to the UK? Do they use that to benefit Britons, or do they use that to bring in people from the Commonwealth and the Commonwealth immigrants? For those who don't know, these are places like Africa and
Exactly. It's the remnants of the British Empire, so it covers a large segment of the globe, and it's all sorts of people from outside Europe. So yes, it's exactly.
Well, and
it's
I remember
the worst reason to object to the EU was that you got immigrants from Europe.
I remember Nigel Farage in 2015 making one of the central tenets of this anecdote he would repeat time and time again was about Polish builders. You know, we have so many Polish builders in this country, and that's a big problem. But Nigel, ask any of the millions of people the 52-53% of Britons that voted for Brexit, the migrant group they actually have the biggest problem with, and it's not going to be Poles. If you ask them and they answer honestly, it will not be Poles.
No, of course not. They are actually, I believe, the biggest immigrant group in Britain, but you would never know it. And that's kind of the point.
Right.
They just blend in. It's not a problem, you know, in any way. Well, I mean, there are, obviously, it's not ideal, but still, it's trivial compared to immigration from outside Europe. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows that. Everyone knows that. But of course, part of the problem with the Brexit thing is that the pro-Remainers would try to guilt trip you into saying, just admit it, you're just racist, you're just anti-immigration. And so many Brexiteers would say, oh, no, I don't care. I'm open-minded. I love different restaurants and so on. So they would not be honest about. I mean, yeah, there are. I don't want to simplify this. There were many and still are many reasons to want Britain out of the EU. But it is, I think the left were correct about this when they said this, and the Brexit side would quiver in fear. The left were correct to say that implicit in the Brexit vote was a certain ethnocentrism.
Yes. Yeah, and they said the same thing with the election of Donald Trump in 2016.
Exactly.
And they did some polling after the election and found that Trump was buoyed to victory by white working class voters that had not voted in years or had voted Democrat for years in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, who had felt alienated from the electoral system and came back to vote. And they were voting based on and they tried to pathologize this and introduce like it's some kind of psychological problem these people had. Oh, fear of a changing country, a fear of changing demographics. But like, and this is the thing, when they say that, oh, you're racist or you're anti, you know, anti whatever, oftentimes the answer is actually yes. You know, you do hold those beliefs, but the important,
but not in the terms that they say, right. And it's not a hateful thing. That's the crucial thing. Right. They're trying to say that to care about your own group is to be hateful and negative and driven by evil in some way.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
They've attached an evil moral connotation to what has been throughout history a natural and proper instinct among people, which is to care for their own first, care for their own civilization first. And this has been, it's been perverted and turned on its head into again, one of these third rails that people don't want to touch. And so even with, with the Trump campaign, and this is one of the reasons the Trump campaign lost in 2020, was the focus they placed on minority voter turnout.
Yeah. The African Americans and Hispanics, right, and so on. Apparently they did actually get a bit of an increase in Black American, African American voting for Trump, which is amazing. But as one of my previous guests said, if they had concentrated on the white vote, they would have won with an absolute landslide. Mm-hmm. Because white Americans would just be so glad that somebody suddenly acknowledged them and cared about them.
Yeah, and there's a rumor going around that Trump won the biggest share of African American voters of any Republican. That's not true. George Bush did better than him. Same with Hispanics, and same with Asians, actually. George Bush did better with all three groups than Donald Trump did. So for, you know, and this is with Trump promising billions of dollars in reparations, right, with the Platinum Plan for blacks. And even with that, he couldn't beat what George Bush got with blacks. And you're right. So people, you know, want to, and this is another way the distraction is just like careened off the cliff into something relatively meaningless with voter fraud. Like, oh, Donald Trump would have won if it weren't for these, you know, ballots found in trucks in Pennsylvania or whatever. And look, voter fraud has happened in the United States for a long time. Voter fraud does happen. And Donald Trump had the opportunity to crack down on voter fraud in 2017 and 2018 with the Kris Kobach Voter Fraud Commission, which he set up seemingly, and if you believe what he was saying, to investigate voter fraud, make sure it never happened again. But what happened was the Department of Justice did not give, Trump's Department of Justice did not give that voter fraud commission the power of subpoena to access these state records, so they couldn't do anything, right? So they were there. They twiddled their thumbs. They were never fully funded, and they were wound down 6 months later. So if Donald Trump were that concerned about voter fraud, the opportunity to address that was months ago. And
well, it's the same with censorship on social media. Oh, yeah. I mean, he talked about this as well, closely monitoring, never actually did a damn thing.
No, because the people that were censored, and I may have made this point on last year's stream, but it's increasingly clear now, the people who were censored from social media, from YouTube and Twitter and that, they were almost without exception critics of the president. They were people who were turning on Trump in 2018 and 2019 for failing to deliver on his promises. The people that have been kept around, that still have their blue checks, still have the channels, these are people that derided those that turned on the president as federal agents, as Whig Nats, as extremists, and have doubled down into, you know, we need to stop the steal. Donate money to me and we can, you know, ? Trump becomes president. And so it's this grift apparatus has been left in place. So in retrospect now, as Trump is, you know, leaving office in what, 21 days, we can see that there was never any incentive for the president to stop censorship because those that were censored were his biggest critics, right? So that's the thing. And returning to the point about going after the white vote, that's absolutely right. If they had won, those 5% of white voters that stayed home, that were Trump voters, that were not afraid of voting for Trump, they were not afraid of being called racist, they were not scared by BLM or Antifa to not go to the polls, they simply recognized this president as a charlatan, as somebody who lied to them and failed to deliver. If they had won those votes, they would have won, and voter fraud would not even be an issue, right? They would have won by margins that would have rendered the voter fraud irrelevant. And so, you know, people that want to just derail this into, oh, Dominion voting system and Chinese CCP hackers and secret servers in Germany, all of that is a deflection from the failings of this presidency. And it's being done in order to keep this myth of Trumpism alive, to keep this energy behind the Republican Party. And I've said this before on our show, the Republican Party is at their happiest when they see people out there saying, we need to destroy the Republican Party, we need to burn the party to the ground, because they know that 95% of those people will be voting Republican next time around. So, you know, they love it when people think that, oh, we're gonna, you know, do this and we're gonna change things, because the system is set up in such a way that you can't. And I learned this very acutely. And, you know, I've gone into this a little bit before, where I had a position in a local Republican Party, and after pressure from the Daily Beast, which is a Zionist paper, they're liberals, but they're, you know, they write in lockstep with AIPAC on Israel. Isn't that interesting? They, you know, drummed me out, and they've done this to people across the country. And I've had conversations in the past few years with people who have come to me and said, "Look, we know what happened with you and the party. but we think we can, you know, get you back into some position. We can get you, we're going to run, I want to run you for this seat or for that seat. And the first couple of times I talked to these people, and within an hour of the conversation starting, there was always the condition that, well, in order to do that, you know, we're going to have to apologize for things that have been said, or you can't talk about about this as much anymore.
Yeah, so it's a matter of neutering you.
Absolutely, yeah, and this is what they'll do to everybody who thinks that there is going to be some path forward to. I mean, I don't even know. This is part of the problem too. The language that we use doesn't actually describe anything, because I don't know what people who say we're going to reform the Republican Party, what do they actually want to accomplish? What are the goals? This gets back to the problem of cloaking your message behind so many cloaks that you don't even know what the goal is anymore. And so for a lot of these people who would have been described as you know, on the dissident right or pro-white a few years ago, are now, I don't even know what they want. Like, what are their qualms with the Trump administration, with the status quo? What's the goal here, other than getting Republicans elected? And yeah, and so this
and
is why.
What end? Exactly. I mean, once you've got the Republicans elected, then what? Because you've already acquiesced to a political culture that doesn't want, that is explicitly against everything that you want.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is why I think increasingly, and another good development of 2020 is people are increasingly seeing this. People are increasingly recognizing that betterment of ourselves, betterment of our families, of our civilization, of our culture, is not going to come through spending time and energy and money. And there's a lot of money going to people who, you know, look, the data's out there. People who are telling you that, you know, you need to fight and die for Donald Trump. These people are being very well paid. Okay. These are people who are they're taken care of. And because there are a lot of people out there searching for answers. And I understand that people want an answer. And it's very easy when we have been raised in the United States, I would assume in the UK and across the West as well, to believe that to change the society around you, all you need to do, and this is especially pronounced in America, but the best way to do that is to go out there and run for office and make a change. And the electoral process is just so second nature for Americans who want to change something about their society that it becomes a very appealing option for people. And when there's a force out there, a very well-paid contingent telling people, yeah, it's as easy as taking over the Republican Party. It's as easy as changing things within the party. Then we'll get what we want. People will think, okay, I'll go along with that. I'll try that. But in the process, look, I've been involved in party politics. I've been involved in campaigns. I've done, you know, the 16-hour door knock for candidates before. You spend a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of mental energy, importantly, placing this as the highest priority. And we know, based on how the system is structured, it will all be for naught. So for people out there who are looking for answers, I think, you know, placing electoral participation at the top of what you're going to do to better yourself is a fallacy. And if you want to actually better yourself, and I don't claim to be the biggest expert on this, but things like, you know, forging healthy relationships with your family, healthy relationships with your neighbors, getting to know people around you, forging healthy relationships with women is something that for a lot of people who have come out of like the MRA sphere and have seen sexual relationships as another political entity, this can be challenging. And look, this is not to discount third wave feminism. All of that is obviously a problem, but, you know, doing things that are concrete that can actually put you in a better position to live a healthy and prosperous life where you're not going to be feeling as much pressure from this system. These are all great things that people can do. And they're much more useful expenditures of energy, I would say, than electioneering.
I had a guy on last night called Luke Smith, and he was basically saying a similar thing, that you should concentrate on self-improvement and in improving your own life and maximizing your control over your own life rather than trying to change society. Well, what would you say about that?
I would agree. Yeah, I would generally agree. But there always needs to be a balance. And this is part of the problem with internet culture, I think, where people, somebody will say one thing and another person will say another, and then people feel like they're forced to choose between the two, that there is one hard and fast answer, one like a silver bullet that's going to fix all the problems, and there's not. So what he's saying is absolutely right, I would say, but there needs to be a balance between a symbiosis, so to speak, between your focus on the self, on the family, on the community, and society as a whole, because you can't just totally check out.
Well, that's what I was thinking. There is the danger of just being the guy in the forest, and, right. and eventually the government come and, you know, just cut down the forest and fuck you up.
Right. Yeah. And that's where networking becomes very important. And that's where true community building becomes very important, because look, I get the urge every day, all the time. You see another drag queen story hour in your community. You see another BLM march in your community, and you just feel that impulse building within you to, you know, sell all of your property and move to the woods and you know, live a pastoral lifestyle. And like, look, you know, this is something that for a lot of people, they think, you know, this is all I can do. I want to get my family as far away from this as I can. But you're never going to be left alone. And that's the problem. You're never... There are no number of exits down the highway you can run, no amount of forest roads you can drive up that will let you truly escape from this. As long as you're within the West and within the sphere of influence of those that have turned it against itself, then there is no escape. And so strength is going to come not from rugged individualism. And this is another problem. People have watched so many Hollywood movies and internalized this American myth that one man can do the John Smith Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and do this like one man stand against the system. We can't. Strength is going to come from communities and from people, like-minded people, recognizing the problems that we face and coming together to solve them in ways that are maybe there will be some time. And I don't want to totally discount, you know, electoral participation. Maybe there will be some time where you can run for mayor of your town or you know, city council of your town, and that's fine if that's how you feel like your energies will be best used. But seriously, like knowing your neighbors, knowing people around you who can help out in times of need, because as we're seeing with the COVID lockdown, with the total failure of Western governments to take care of their people, the state has no interest in looking after you. The state has no interest in making you whole and sustaining you. And so these are things that we need to rely on each other for, and we need to rebuild from the atomization that we've all fallen into.
Can you see America balkanizing? Can you see it splitting apart?
I don't a qualified no. And this is the same problem with the civil war predictions people have, is what would the battle lines be, right? What would the balkanization lines be in this case? Because I think people are so turned against one another, neighbor against neighbor. There's so much division in the U.S., even within these regions that would be, in theory, the different, balkanized areas. I just don't see how that happens. And I think, to be honest, that the United States system, the corporate media governmental system, is strong enough that it could prevent that. And, you know, balkanization is a very serious step. And even when states have tried to do things that are, further scaled back from that, express their sovereignty in other ways, they have been punished for doing so. For example, in North Carolina, when they passed a law requiring people, transgenders, to use the bathroom of their biology, they were simply threatened economically by major corporations, including the NBA and others, and they were forced to pull back. And so because of not even globalization of our economy, but this highly financialized economy we have, there are so many levers of power over different states and over different communities that it's very hard for a state or for a community to express their will and to stand up to the Leviathan. So you could easily foresee if some state, let's say, you know, people like to talk about Idaho. Let's say if Idaho decides, you know, we're going to become our own independent republic, how long does that last when these companies that are owned by, you know, major financial firms like BlackRock, Larry Fink's BlackRock, say, okay, you do that, we're pulling all of the jobs. We're shutting down the timber mills or whatever interests they hold in these states and just crippling their economy. So I don't see a way that that would actually work out.
It really is astonishing the number of ways that a corporation could punish a state, a city, or even a country. I mean, you've got to remember, it's outside of America, Ireland is basically the plaything of Google and right. Microsoft and so on, and Twitter. They don't give a shit. They don't give a shit about the local traditions, local culture, even the law, the government. They'll have that changed. They have had things changed in the Irish law.
The abortion bill, for example, right? Where the majority of Irish people wanted to keep abortion prohibited, and Google and Facebook, they spend millions of dollars lobbying and they get that changed.
Yeah, it was a PR campaign, though. It was, I mean, I don't know the details of this, but it wasn't that they basically talked the Irish people into a very new way of thinking. Let's put it that way, such that I think they had a referendum on abortion in 2004 and they voted strongly against it. But then they had another one, I think, in 2015 or something, or no, more recent than that, and they voted for it. That is my understanding. Somebody might well correct that. But either way, these corporations changed the culture and the laws of a country. That's how powerful they are now. And it's quite staggering. And I think that when we talk about mounting a resistance to this, we have to be very practical about it, because there is no room for just pie in the sky and hoping for the best and heroic rhetoric that doesn't actually lead to anything. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something we've really got to internalize in the distant right, because there are so many people who just think, well, why can't we just, like someone said last night, how about just reversing the Hart-Celler Act? Well, yeah, that would be good, but how are you going to get that done?
Right.
It's not that it's not a good idea. It's that you've got to start from where you actually are. I think a lot of people don't get that.
Yeah, and you need to understand that that these party structures, and look, if the Hart-Celler Act was put to a vote in the United States, absent any corporate interference, absent any pressure from Antifa or threats, you know, violent threats made against people that opposed it, it would be overturned. I mean, opinion polls show that the majority opinion on immigration in America among Republicans, Democrats, the whole country, is to either keep it at the level it's at or reduce it or eliminate it. Right, this is what a very small amount of Americans actually want to see: more immigration, especially in 2020 when jobs have become so scarce. But what do the Republicans do? What do the Democrats do? What do they collude to do? They pass measures like House Resolution 1044, Senate Bill 386, together that expanded the visa cap for Indian immigrants and to take more of these good, what used to be good tech jobs from Americans, and make it easier for Indian and Chinese nationals to receive visas to fill them. So, yeah.
And this is another aspect. It used to be just working class jobs that were threatened by globalism. Now it's increasingly middle class jobs as well. And I think that's bound to have cultural and social and political effects in the long term, because it used to be something that the middle class could look down on, you know, blue collar workers and say, ha, you're worried about losing your job at the box factory, ha, which is a disgusting attitude. But it was something that they could get away with doing 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. But now it's coming for them as well. It's coming for their jobs as well. And I think this is, I don't know what the globalist plan is for handling the backlash to this, because there's definitely going to be a backlash. I mean, millions of intelligent people are getting dispossessed now.
And people who are in significant amounts of debt, who took out large loans to pay for a college education on the promise that on the other end they would be put into a good job, and they're not. And so
this is a big thing. I remember talking about this quite early. I think in 2015, I did a video about this failure to launch thing, where you had these people, including myself, who, and many people that I had known at school, who'd gone to university expecting, okay, I will have a social status equal to my parents. My kids will grow up like I grew up. But actually, no. You're going to be working in a call center in your late 20s and even into your 30s and so on. And you're not going to have that professional job that your parents had because they're not needed anymore. Or because there are just so many people going to university now, so you can't compete.
And there's so much competition from foreign labor that's coming in. It can be outsourced very easily. And so these what used to be professional level jobs, like I have a few friends who went into college the same time I did, and they were looking at the tech industry at the time and said, I'll be able to comfortably get an $80,000 a year job on the other side of this with a you know 4-year degree in information technology or computer science or what have you. And they got their degree and they graduated and they were in debt. And the only jobs they were being offered were for, you know, $40,000-$45,000 a year. Oh, and by the way, to do those jobs, you had to live in a major city like Seattle or San Francisco, where you just simply can't afford to live, right? And so you end up living 4 people to a 2-bedroom apartment. Very poor living conditions, and living conditions that are starting to emulate the third world from which many of these workers are coming. And that's the other thing, is these companies, you know, look, when you have somebody who is coming from Bangladesh or from Sri Lanka or from India, who grew up on the streets of Bombay and was living in a corrugated metal roof shack, if they were lucky, and they come to the U.S., they, you know, living 8 people to a 2-bedroom house with some of their coworkers, that's luxury for them. You know, that's a massive step up, because their cultural living expectations for living conditions simply aren't as high. But if you ask an American to do that, they'll be appalled, because, you know, they grew up in a country where their dad could work 50 hours a week, 40, 50 hours a week, and live in a single family home and have 2 cars in the driveway and get 2 weeks of paid vacation a year and live a comfortable life and have time to do things other than work. And this is something that you'll see Americans, or you used to see Americans, like, mock the French for, right? And mock Europeans. Well, these lazy French, they only work 20 or 30 hours a week. Well, what can they do with that extra time? You know, they can spend time with their families. They can pursue hobbies. They can read. They can pursue creative projects that enrich themselves and their communities and make them better people. They're not slaves to their corporate master. But what the globalists are doing is simultaneously importing a class of people that don't have any desire to live these ascended lives, I guess you could say, and conditioning Americans that is how you need to live as well. I mean, it's not that long ago that having 2 jobs would have been something that is reserved for people who are really down on their luck or had some kind of problem. But now it's the norm. It's absolutely the norm. I mean, the 2-parent the amount of households in America that are able to get by with children, you know, a married couple with children with only 1 income, it's actually very small, especially compared to what it was 50 years ago. And now both of those parents, the expectation is they're going to work 2 jobs. And in between those 2 jobs, you know, on their commute home, they'll drive for Uber or something. They'll do some kind of gig economy work where they have no labor protection. And so, you know, but this is something that for Americans, again, back in the 1940s and 50s, where the rate of unionization was around 30 or 50%, depending on your industry, the rate of unionization in America now, I believe it's down below 10%. And this is just the new normal. This is just the new normal.
What you just were saying a couple of minutes ago reminded me of an article that I read a year ago. And so I've linked it in the live chats on DLive and YouTube. And it's something called PodShare. You might have heard of it at the time.
Yes, yeah.
This bunk bed in San Francisco rents for $1,200 a month. It's a bunk bed, and it's in a dormitory with loads of other people. A PodShare membership allows you to try to snag any of the 220 beds at 6 locations across Los Angeles and 1 in San Francisco. There's no deposit and no commitment. You get a bed, a locker, access to Wi-Fi, and the chance to meet fellow podestrians. Each pod includes a shelf and a personal television. And it really, I remember thinking, this is incredible, because this, it's presumably for people who they're trying to, it's a way to address the shortage of affordable apartments in these huge cities where things are like property is extremely expensive. So, and of what you don't get, privacy. But that's an easy trade-off, say the mostly young people who live there and people in their 20s and so on. I mean, this is incredible stuff. You're living in a bunk bed with a shelf and you don't get privacy, and which in turn reminds me of the thing the World Economic Forum said that in 2030 you won't have privacy, you won't have property, you won't own anything. Effectively, you'll be living like this. Mm-hmm. It's quite
you'll own nothing, and nothing will be private, and you'll love it. That's the upshot of that. And yeah, we're returning to conditions that you would have seen for a lot of people. You would have seen as a serf, basically, olden times,
feudal Europe. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No. It's a feudal society, but the difference is, I guess, you have a television on which to watch Marvel movies and pornography. So,
yeah.
You know.
It's dreadful. See, I remember, this is something I haven't said on Millennial this year, because it only occurred to me a couple of nights ago. But I remember about 10 years ago now, hearing about what life was like at Google HQ. I think it's, I don't know where that is, somewhere in Silicon Valley. And it was this huge, huge building. And the workers, Google staff, had all this stuff I think they had a school for their kids. I'm pretty sure they had a medical center. It was all paid for by Google. You didn't need to worry about bills or anything. And also there were these workshops where you could learn skills that had nothing to do with coding, nothing to do with programming or software. It was woodwork, carpentry, metalwork, all that kind of stuff. So it's like the corporation gives you an entire life almost. Looks after every aspect of your life. And you do the job that they want you to do. And then in return, they basically take care of your entire life. And I remember thinking, bloody hell, that's quite amazing, quite incredible, because they've got so much money, the corporation, that they can do this for their workers. And on the one hand, it's admirable. But the caveat is that you can always leave. You can always get a job somewhere else if you don't, you know, if it becomes too suffocating, or if you don't like the fact that they're infantilizing you, you can always just get a job elsewhere. It feels to me like with the Great Reset and so on, they now want that kind of culture, that kind of situation across the whole of society, so that you can't ever leave.
I think what they want is precarity, and they want people constantly aware of the fact that everything they have can be taken away. And if you, for example, if you're a worker and you sleep in the Google pod and you're dependent on Google for your laundry service, for your food, for every meal, are you ever going to speak up against Google? Are you ever going to take any political action that the system might not like? Well, no, you're not, because everything you have can be taken away overnight. You can be fired for saying the wrong thing on the internet, right? And so this system of precarity, you know, companies will offer these benefits and things to people, tech companies specifically. I have a friend who works in the gaming industry, and they pay for the Uber to work, they do your laundry at work for you, like everything is taken care of. But everything can be lost at the same time if you step out of line, if you don't work hard enough, right? If they ask the 70-hour work week of you and you say, no, I have family commitments, that can be taken from you. And that same precarity is, you know, with gig work, for example, you can have your account deactivated. You can essentially be fired and replaced and have no recourse for that. And you can lose your ability to make that money that you need either to sustain yourself or to bridge, you know, paycheck to paycheck. So the model of precarity, I think, is what they want to institute, what they have instituted to great effect across the country and across the West. And again, you know, this is part of why labor unions had to be destroyed. Sure, there are some problems with labor unions, and with their management and organization. But the promise of the labor union always was that if you were going to be terminated or fired or laid off, you would have a union of people behind you, or that the company couldn't, in many cases, because of a bargaining agreement you had made with the company, that you and the union had made with the company. So all of that is being wound down, is being destroyed. And I think what they want, generally speaking, regardless of what industry you're in or what the size of company you work for, they want people so afraid of losing everything. And this is why they've built up, at the same time, this surveillance apparatus and this surveillance culture, where not only what you say on your social media can be used to drum you out of a job years later, but what you're seen doing in public as recorded by someone else's camera phone, by really normal behavior, calling the police, for example, is now cause for losing your job. If you're being threatened by a jogger, say, in Central Park.
This was the Karen Act.
Yeah.
They actually came up with an acronym.
And because they want people living so on edge at all times that you are not going to stick your head up and take any kind of political risk or take any kind of organizing risk or speak up against what's going on. And think about like a very real example of this, right? If you work for, say, the city government, or you work, if you're a police officer, there's a police officer a few days ago who was fired for posts he had made on Parler. There was, not to defend all the police or whatever, that's a nuanced subject. But generally speaking, if you are the guy who goes to, let's say, protest drag queen story hour in your community, and your photo is taken by the newspaper, you're interviewed maybe, or you're identified, your company can fire you and you have no protections, because so many states have adopted right to work laws in recent years that you can be terminated without cause. And this is another thing. You mentioned the elites and their changing opinions. Some very interesting data came out from Pew a few days ago, where they did a poll on the partisan alignment of people based on their educational background. So people who were working class, no college, high school, up to college education and graduate education. And there has been a very rapid and dramatic shift in partisan alignment in the United States, from people who with graduate degrees and college degrees have shifted overwhelmingly to the Democratic Party. I think 50% almost of the Democratic Party, people who say they're Democrats, have some kind of graduate degree or undergraduate degree. And the Republican Party has become supported by more working class people who've gone to trade school, high school education, limited college education. But when you look at what these parties are supporting, the Republican Party is supporting right to work legislation. The Republican Party is opposing stimulus checks that would go to help these people who have been most affected. People, I mean, look, elites, most elites can do their LGBT coding seminars or whatever from their bug pod. Okay. They've not been economically impacted by COVID for the most part, but the guy who, I don't know, owns an HVAC company, who relies on building new homes or working on businesses, those businesses are shut down. That guy has been without a paycheck for months now. What is he going to do? He needs the support of frankly, the state right now, and he's not going to get it because he's, they've been checked.
This similar thing happened in Britain decades ago, where the working class who are socially conservative will vote for the Conservative Party or the Republicans, yeah. And it's against their own economic and very much against their own economic interests. On the matter of Democrat voters often being university educated, they always use this as a thing that, well, educated people are left wing, educated people are liberal, and so on. I think there's probably some truth to this in the sense of trait openness. I can get that making them liberal. But you've also got to bear in mind that university is nothing but a factory for indoctrination now. It's a leftist indoctrination system. So, of course, most people who go through it, and we know this, I mean, statistically about college lecturers, professors, the vast, like, astonishing, like 90% of them are consider themselves left wing or something. I can't remember where that came from. I'm pretty sure it was in America. An astonishing percentage of them are self-identify as left wing. So, of course, the education that they give is going to encourage left-wing values, liberal values, socialists, whatever. So, of course, the students are going to come out at the other end voting Democrat. Obviously, they are.
Yeah, or even if they're not voting Democrat, believing in the fundamentals of liberalism, right? And so even people who will come out of that system, highly educated people who are Republicans, will be very fiscally conservative and socially liberal. And that's exactly where, that's where they want people, opposing nominally socialist economics that would help the working class and supporting diversity and LGBT issues and all of that. Right. And
yeah, so it's whatever is bad for social or maybe ethnic cohesion.
Yeah.
Whatever is it? Because there's not going to be any welfare or any substantial welfare. You're all going to be competing against each other. But also there's going to be drag queen story hour.
Yes. Yeah. And universities and schools generally, why do we have schools? Well, they're to teach behaviors that we want people to have, to educate, but also to teach people, to socialize people in a certain way. And those schools, to deny, and I don't know if anybody does this, but to deny that then putting someone through 16 years of undergraduate education, or 16 years of primary and undergraduate education, and then another 4 to 6 of graduate education, 22 years of schooling. So by the time someone is 26, 27 years old, having that taught them almost from birth the state ideology of neoliberalism, it's going to be very difficult for someone to dissent from that. And this is part of why they've made a push in recent years to do the pre-K education, to get kids into the school system as early as like 6 months old, to separate them from their families as early as they can, to keep them in the schools as long as they can, and then to saddle them with debt that they have to pay back. So you see how the economic precarity and this neoliberal education system are tying together, where if you emerge from the system and you do want to dissent against it, well, you need your income so to pay down your student loans and to pay down all the debt that you've incurred. So are you really going to take the risk to speak out against what's going on? Probably not, because you know that you'll lose your ability to not only feed yourself, but to pay down the debt, which, by the way, it cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. You're saddled with it forever. So, yeah.
Yes, yes. So I guess, we've talked about some very serious systemic problems in society, but we did agree that we want to be fairly optimistic for people, if possible. So, and there are questions on entropy for you as well. But, okay, I'll start by asking some of those, and then we can get to other stuff. So Dave Riley, who I think you know,
yes.
He said, keep having interesting conversations, put this towards a new synth, and he donates $20. Thank you very much. If anyone else wants to help me buy a new synth, then please donate in any way you can. That'd be much appreciated.
Do you play music?
I don't play, but I use it for sound effects and ambience and stuff like that for my videos. It's also just therapeutic. It's something nice to twiddle away on. I really enjoy them. And yes, I do intend to learn to play the actual piano as well at some point, but so far I've just, because there's just so much to do, even for when I'm, well, there's just usually so much to do that I don't have to, I've never found time to do these things, which is ridiculous, but I really should learn how to play the piano. It's obvious.
I know exactly. I'm looking at my guitars on the wall that I've bought and said, this time I'm gonna learn,
Yeah, it's a strange thing. But yeah, I do love synthesizers, and everything on the channel is made by me on using various synthesizers. And yes, there is one that I have my eye on, and I've had my eye on it since more than a year ago now. So I would like to get that. So yes, if people want to donate, please do. I've not been very pushy about that this millennial, and people kept saying, just say it, just say people can donate if they want to, but I always feel very self-conscious doing that. Anyway, so thank you, Dave Riley. James and Woes, is there this libertarian mindset many white people have that you find frustrating? James debated, yes, there is. I think that white people are, that's the short answer. I think that white people are, especially men, are given to this libertarian mindset that effectively castrates them. It makes them incapable of any sort of collective or even contemplating collective action because they think that's weakness, when actually it's the only source of strength that's available to you. As an individual, you cannot fight against collective interests and especially corporate interests. As an individual, you don't stand a chance. You're a gnat that they can easily crush underfoot. That's the truth of the matter. So I think libertarianism effectively castrates people. But anyway, James debated Sticks, and it seems that libertarianism values ideology over people. How would libertarianism work in Somalia or Baltimore? Well, exactly. James, libertarianism values ideology over people. I think that's very true. I think it also just values an elegant idea over reality.
Well, it values the pursuit of like ultimate profitability over the rights and well, it values profitability over well-being of people. And look, when I first got into politics when I was like 14 or 15 years old, I was very much into ANCAP-ism, very much into in that side of the, you know, Rothbard and that. But I think the realization that I've come to, and that a lot of people have come to, and well, we need to start with why people embrace libertarianism. Why is that even an attractive option? That is an attractive option because for a lot of people, they see the system as it is. They see the government, they see the corporate system, and they think this is inefficient. This doesn't serve me. So therefore, by doing away with government, with minimal government, we'll have maximum freedom, and then we can form these voluntary associations that we want. But what that misses is that corporations are not guided by profitability. If corporations were purely guided by profitability, they would allow for, on the internet, they would allow for maximal free speech. Places like Amazon would sell every kind of book there is, and they would incentivize what's popular, which are ideas like ours, to flourish and profit from them. But what we see is that companies are not guided by profitability. Companies are guided by ideology, and that is an ideology that is bestowed to them by those that control them, those that with holding the financial strings. We know who they are, and so they don't function in this hyper-rationalist way that libertarians would like them to function. Now, having some kind of independent spirit, being, you know, willing to say, look, I want to get something done, so I'm going to do it. I think these are good instincts, and these are some of the instincts that have allowed for some of the great pioneering and innovation that we've seen out of Western and European peoples throughout our history. So these are a good trait, but they need to be balanced again with respect for the community and with a sense of responsibility to people who are a part of your extended national family. And that's what, again, another thing libertarians miss, right? Is that if someone is poor, well, let them die, because clearly they are not, you know, this optimal economic performance. They don't meet the minimum threshold of economic performance to function in our system. Therefore, they're useless. And it reduces people's utility and their humanity into solely what they can provide economically. And that's just not, it's antithetical to how thriving and successful cultures, European cultures, have treated one another and treated each other within that community throughout all of history. Like, look, there are always going to be people in our society who are down on their luck, who are not as capable, who are not as intelligent or whatever, but that doesn't mean they're useless. They just have a different role in society. And I think that's what libertarians tend to miss.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Another thing that comes up from what you've said is the myth. And I think we might have talked about it last year, but you definitely made a video about it, solely about this. The misconception that companies, corporations that go woke, go right. broke.
Right, yeah. And this is another myth that... the bean-eat one himself will often purvey on YouTube. And it's this kind of prophecy that these people set up, because here's another problem. People always, I don't want to say always, it's an overgeneralization, but a lot of people feel that there is some kind of invisible pendulum that's always swinging, and that things will always correct themselves just given enough time and that our like sense of morality will win out, and these crazy radical zany liberals are going to going to get what's coming to them someday. But it's not true. It doesn't happen like that. That is not borne out in reality. Companies that quote go woke, which at this point in America could be extended to almost every single major corporation, have some diversity initiative, have some policy in place to hire fewer white men, to push white men, in fact, out of key positions in the company, have advertising that directly attacks the idea of the normative, heteronormative white family. All of these companies are doing that, and none of them are going broke. In fact, they're profiting more than ever. Amazon is one of the wokest companies there is, and they're making record profits. So I don't think there's been a single example of company that's gone woke and gone broke. So I think the burden of proof would be on somebody who says that to actually provide one single case in which that's happened. And the other thing is, if a company does, go woke and gets into some kind of financial peril, there are trillionaire investment bankers out there willing to keep that company afloat, because the message they provide and the cultural message they're sending is more important than the profit, right? Like Avengers movies could lose money. Every single Avengers movie could lose money, but they would keep making them because they continue to provide a helpful cultural mythos that the system wants to impart on people.
Exactly. I mean, to coin a phrase, it's not about the money; it's about sending a message. It's just doesn't matter. These corporations have so much money anyway that it really doesn't matter. Obviously it doesn't matter. Demonstrably, they don't care anymore. So I think that to say that they'll go, I again point an example of it actually happening. But even if it did happen, I think a lot of the people involved in these corporations wouldn't care, because they'd think, well, yeah, it went broke, but it went broke in a good cause.
Well, yeah, and I just can't think of a single example of a company, going broke. Like the NFL, for example, has had its problems, yet they continue to turn a profit. The NBA continues to turn a profit. So and to the extent these companies are losing revenue, a lot of that has to do with people not wanting to leave their homes and go to live events or whatever. So, and look, you can maybe find a few isolated examples of companies that have lost a little bit of money, or that have had a rough time with sales or something. But generally speaking, these companies that are imparting this morality onto people have such an impermeable monopoly in the market sphere that they are just are not afraid of any risk, right? Like, what are you going to do to Facebook or Google to punish them for decisions they make? There's really nothing that you can do. And let's say you're going to buy hardware and you're really upset that Bernie Marcus, who owns Home Depot, donates to Uber Zionist politicians. Okay, so you go to Lowe's. Well, Lowe's announced their $400 billion initiative to give money to Black and minority-owned businesses. So that's your dichotomy. That's your choice that you have. And
Exactly. I mean, and again, I think you and I both got banned from Twitter. There is no other Twitter. I mean, yes, there are alternatives, but there is no real substitute for Twitter. That's where the public are. So what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. I mean, we went ahead and got banned anyway, but the point is that to say, well, you can just build your own or something, is just crazy. And with some things, there simply is no alternative. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to do? But I think with a lot of these things, it's really that you've just got to stand by and watch the culture coming up with these things, like Marvel movies and so on, completely paused because you... What can you do to stop? I mean, I don't know. This is a big dilemma because how do you stop your children getting infected with this stuff? I don't know. But I do think that to just rest on the idea that these companies will go broke doing this stuff is for a start, it's just delusional. That's it would be hoping for the best. But the evidence is already in that it doesn't even work. It doesn't even happen.
So well, and there are some concrete steps you can take, and there are things that you can do that actually are beneficial that keep money from going to them. That, you know, they may seem inconsequential on an individual level, but when enough people start doing them, for example, supporting local businesses, and you know, sure, maybe some local business owner is a liberal, or you don't agree with them on all politics, but that action is keeping wages and keeping money in your local community, and not just sending it off and draining your community of wealth to give to Amazon or to Walmart or whomever. So there are things you can do like that, patronizing places in your community that actually will be beneficial. And the negative impact that will have on an Amazon is minor. The negative impact from that lost revenue on Walmart, it's relatively inconsequential to them, but it's massively consequential to the people whom you're supporting. So yeah, I mean, when you don't like what Amazon does politically, or what Walmart does politically, or what Gillette or whomever does politically, what you can do instead of, and this is again the individual wanting to change the world, instead of hoping for something you can do to like bring about their destruction, you can just not support them. And I'm not saying that's going to solve the problem, but it's a concrete step you can take in your own life to at least be at peace with yourself and know that what you're doing isn't directly furthering these companies that would love to see you, you know, living in a pod or dead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's kind of grim. Okay, someone says, taking the Varg pill is naive. I don't know why this came up. Did we mention this? Oh, yes, about going into the forest. And sure. Yeah, I said it. Taking the Varg pill is naive because the state won't leave you alone. And neither the state, but also the big corporations won't leave you alone. Taking political action is naive because the certain powers own the system. If both of these things are true, aren't we all just cope posting? That's a very good question.
I don't think you are, because again, this mindset, and I understand where this commenter is coming from, but this relies on the Hollywood three act film type of thinking about societal struggle, in that there needs to be some kind of immediate resolution that's within your grasp, with a very clear, like quest markers in a video game for, you know, go to this waypoint, problem solved. It's not going to be that easy. And I don't think these are problems that are going to be resolved in our youth, possibly not even in our lifetimes, possibly not even in our children's lifetimes. So recognizing that electoral action is non-viable, that's a good start. Recognizing that total retreat is non-viable is also a good start. And from there, you need to find that balance. And this, and the term is often overused, but making one's family and community anti-fragile, not relying on money coming in from the massive companies, and that can be difficult. But the phrase, again, is so overused, but building community, but just things like knowing your neighbor, things like getting involved in local organizations where you can meet people who can help you in times of need, whom you can help in times of need, and whom you can have conversations like this about, that is a very viable path forward, because you start talking to people, and people, the majority of people, of decent people like you, whom you'll meet, they also don't like what's going on. They don't like the fact that their children are being taught transgenderism in their elementary school. They don't like they're being taught Black Lives Matter ideology or any of this stuff. They don't like this, but they don't have, or they don't feel like they have a way they can express that, because people, even people who are relatively apolitical, pick up on what they see happening to those who are political, and they think, well, I'm not going to touch that. I'm not going to stick my neck out. So building consensus among people is powerful. And how this looks tangibly, maybe this ends up in a communal, you know, homeschooling type initiative. Maybe this ends up in trading goods and services and teaching, you know, maybe you know woodworking and one of your neighbor is a good mechanic, and you can teach each other these skills and teach your children these skills to decrease your reliance on this system as a whole, on the corporate governmental system as a whole. And these seem like minor things, but again, you know, I'm not trying to promise people, you know, like some kind of Herculean victory, because I think anybody who is promising you that is lying to you. Anybody who's promising that, you know, if we just take X step, then victory will be achieved tomorrow, they're lying. And I hate to have to say that, but it's true. So doing the best we can to build up our own value, to build up our own self-sufficiency, while thinking of ourselves as almost as protectors of our community and shepherds, maybe, of people who are not aware of everything we're aware of, and helping these people navigate and decipher all of this confusing mess they're seeing around them by having the conversation with them, by telling them what's going on, and by preparing them for the powerful forces that may come down on them, right? You know, preparing, telling somebody, hey, you know, you may be upset about this, but going to that protest, for example, or making that angry Facebook post, probably not the best way to go about that, because you know, you could face consequences for that. So, yeah,
and of course, it's not that we're encouraging a fear of consequences. Right. What I would say is it worth? Is the win worth the loss? Is a cost benefit analysis, basically.
And it's not even really a win, because, you know, if you go and look, not to be defeatist, but you need to be very careful about what you do with public activism or public political statement. That's just the reality of where we are. And so you need to make sure if you're doing it, it's for a good cause. And there are some good causes out there that are worth standing up and taking initiative and putting yourself out there for. Absolutely. But yeah, not helping people to not run headfirst into the wood chipper of neoliberal capitalism and to protect their families from it, I think is a very worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, please ask James if he thinks the AMNAT movement will decline after Inauguration Day.
Well, I think that there are people out there who have made exorbitant amounts of money convincing people that the path forward for political salvation for us is to attach ourselves to Donald Trump and to fight, you know, tooth and claw for him to become president again. Never mind all of the failings and betrayals of the last 4 years. Trump is the end all be all. And I think when Joe Biden is inaugurated, there are going to be people who had become deeply invested in that, who are going to be looking for answers and are going to recognize that they were lied to, that's, you know, donating money to stop the steal or whatever it is they did was not a worthwhile cause. And so those people will be searching for answers. And the answer that we need to provide for them is that this electoral system that you're being given a choice in is invalid. It's an illegitimate system, and you're not going to achieve the goals that you have in mind through that system. So to come over to, you know, what we're saying, which is we can have good lives for ourselves, good lives for our families. We can have healthy networks with people. We can have these communities that exist outside of the electoral system. We can be politically active without being electorally active, and we'll be better for it. We'll be expending our energy in a more worthwhile way. Yes, I think that's going to be increasingly clear to people. So the AMNAT phenomenon, it is unfortunate, because the true America First movement of the 1940s and 50s was a very good movement, frankly. They were opposed to war. They were opposed to intervention in World War II. These were people who wanted America to look after itself first, let the European theater sort itself out, and not go headlong into this war that was being fought at the behest of a very small and very well-organized international clique. So that was a great movement back in the time. Unfortunately, what it is now, and again, this gets back to the problem of not really knowing what the goal is. I can't tell you what the goal of someone who says America First is anymore. And, you know, I actually really liked the slogan America First. I don't like the slogan of America First anymore. Because what is America? You know, the true American nation. Yes, I have a great respect for the American nation, for people who have been here for a long time, for people who have integrated themselves in nation, not the American state. But the American state is one of the, is in fact the greatest backstop of, frankly, evil being done worldwide. So I don't have any investment in the American state and in the American democracy and American elections, because, you know, these are not systems that are set up to ever have any benefit for us. So yeah, I think that it's going to be headed for rough times. But what you have to be wary of is the next iteration of this trick. And the reason these systems are able to maintain their relevance is because of a constant influx of political neophytes who, it's their first rodeo, and they don't know any better. And so I'm not that old. I'm only, 25? But I remember the election of 2008. I remember the election of 2012. And I remember the sentiment people had that, look, and this was the approach people had with the Republican Party, which is, if you are not going to do what I want you to do, then I'm not going to vote for any single Republican ever again. And they recognized that, and they had to do a course correction in 2008 by running Donald Trump, who, again, was a product of this Arthur Finkelstein school of politics, was very close with Benjamin Netanyahu, who recognized that in order to get a Republican elected, they needed to say things that were, that actually resonated with people: ending immigration, bringing jobs back, in a meaningful way that had not been done by any Republican ever before. So for a lot of people, that was their first election, and they got, they became true believers. I became a true believer in 2016. And you need to be careful, because in 2024, 2022, you're going to see them building up an initiative to do that again, to run another candidate who's going to promise you the same great things over again that Trump promised you. And it'll be a little bit different, right? It'll be maybe with a more of an edge of this multi-ethnic working class populism they're talking about, with people like Josh Hawley or Marco Rubio, who will promise you that yes, you know, these are the young guys. These are America first politicians. They're really going to end immigration this time, guys. We promise, seriously. But it's not going to happen. And you need to be very wary of the next iteration of the trick. And you need to inoculate yourselves. People need to inoculate themselves against falling for that again.
Right. Okay. I don't know if there's anything that I would say about this. It's a big topic, and I'm aware that time is running short. So I'll just move on to the next question. Now, what I would ask you about that, do you think that Trump was a GOP trick in that sense? Because you said that they realized they had to go a bit further. So do you think the Republican Party were actually on board? Because it looked like, from outside, it looked like they were on board only after they realized they had no choice. Like, this guy's won the, the nomination and all that. So what would you say about that?
It's tough, and I don't want to definitively say, you know, from afar, diagnose what's going on in someone's mind. What I will say is that we know that Donald Trump's father was a frequent contributor to synagogues in New York. He donated land to build synagogues in New York. Donald Trump himself has donated millions of dollars to Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He is someone who has been close with Benjamin Netanyahu for a long time. They have been, their families have been very closely aligned. In fact, when Benjamin Netanyahu was serving as the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations is when he first became introduced. And this was back in the, I want to say 70s. That's when he first became introduced to Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father. So there are a lot of connections these two families have together. Of course, Ivanka Trump married to Jared Kushner, the Kushner family, close to the Netanyahu's, close enough, in fact, that when Netanyahu visited the United States, he would sleep over at the Kushner's home, kind of odd. So there are a lot of connections there, and that's just scratching the surface. And I, you know, you look back on the Never Trumpers, people like Bill Kristol, people like Ben Shapiro, many of them, you know, sharing a same common ancestry, shall we say, who came out so hard against Trump in 2016. You have to wonder whether that was a legitimate fear or whether that was done in order to make Trump seem more legitimate, in order to legitimize him as a real threat against this neoconservative, neoliberal order. And I don't know definitively, and I don't think anybody will ever know definitively. Maybe we will decades from now. But I think that given the evidence we have, and given the Trump administration's total unwillingness to fight on any of the key issues, being immigration, being race, and what has emerged on the other side of the Trump presidency, I think there's a very compelling case to be made that this was a strategy they were pursuing all along. And we look back to 2014, and the Republican Party was having an internal debate how they would adjust to changing demographics in America. Right, they were seeing the increase in the Hispanic population. They were seeing the beginning of the cresting of the white baby boomer population and the decline of white birth rates, recognizing that if they were going to win elections going forward, they would have to adapt to appeal to Hispanics and appeal to Blacks and appeal to Indians and others that are coming into the country. There was a lot of resistance within the party to this. A lot of people, like I said, were saying, if you don't do what we want in immigration, if you do the gang bait bill, for example, we will never vote for you again. And so they had to again, mold this energy in a way that was safe for them. So in 2016, they used nativism, populism. They use this strong racial in-group feeling that American whites had to get Trump elected. But what have the results been? It's been Trump making the Republican Party bending over backwards to appeal to the LGBT lobby, to appeal to Blacks, to appeal to Hispanics. And so they've gotten it to the point where they wanted to get it in 2014, this big tent, bringing in these non-white groups into the party. And it's remarkable because they did it by appealing to white populism.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a very clever trick, but these are people who are very good at weaving narratives in the media and so on. Okay, James, edgy bumper stickers, based or cringe? I've got my eye on a particular logo, but I can't get myself to throw it on the truck. What do you think? Based, edgy bumper stickers, are they a good idea or not?
Generally speaking, I would say no. But there are some exceptions that are just so direct that I'm almost in admiration of the people that have them. For example, there was one I saw just a few days ago that said, "Dead pedophiles don't reoffend." And I had to do a double take because I wasn't sure if I read that correctly, but I did. So something like that, you know, I would say right on, because I don't think anybody's going to be messing with your car or truck if you have something like that on there. yeah. You have to make a value judgment based on where you live.
All right. James, hung out with you at Amrain. You're a good dude. What do you think about Patrick Casey's decision to disband AIM? Is the membership model the wrong approach for 2021?
Well, it's the right approach if you are going to get in bed with, figuratively, perhaps literally, with people who are noted FBI informants and allies of the ADL, people who work closely with the ADL, people like Milo Yiannopoulos, who, and I've done the research on this. This is irrefutable research. You can find it on dissident-mag.com. The article's titled "The America First Movement Has a Federal Agent Problem." And yeah, I mean, I don't want to turn this into a personal thing or whatever, but look, a membership organization can be fine if you have leadership that is serious about security. On the other hand, if you have leadership that continues to bring their members onto unsecured platforms and allow them to be repeatedly doxxed and then do nothing to help them, not even give them a phone call afterwards, you know, that's a problem. If you are sharing videos on your Twitter that have been released by Milo Yiannopoulos that actually redox members of your organization, that's a problem. So, yeah, but I mean, look, like I said, these people have been very well paid for their services, and mission accomplished, I think, if you're them.
Bloody hell. Okay, for James, what subject do you find easiest to convince a normie of, and which subject is most difficult to convince a normie of? Be careful with this one, James.
I actually don't know if people need that much convincing, because so many people, like I said, have this innate feeling that everything around them is wrong. And it's not that they need to be convinced that these things are wrong. They need to be convinced that they are not wrong for thinking they're wrong. So actually, I'll amend my answer and say the hardest thing to convince people of is that they are not immoral for being natural. They are not immoral for taking pride in themselves and their culture and their ethnicity. They're not immoral for rejecting what is being done to their children. They're not immoral for objecting to their country serving as a puppet state of a warmongering desert nation. Okay, you know, you're not immoral for thinking these things, but people have become so conditioned by, you know, years of public schooling, by absolute control of the media since the 1940s and 1950s especially, that they are somehow in the wrong for thinking these things.
Yeah, I think I would say that the hardest thing is to convince people that their instincts are correct, that there really is something wrong, that there is something fundamentally wrong with society, because so many people don't trust their own instincts and don't trust their own judgment. And so they think, well, I must be mistaken, because the authorities, the government, the experts, the academics, they're all on board with this. So it must be me who's at fault here, when it's not. But you know, it's easy to see why somebody would think that. So, yeah, I would say that. Okay, someone, Angerad Celtic, makes a very generous donation, thank you very much, and says, this is to show my appreciation for Millennial, all of the wonderful guests and your hard work, MW. Although I wish you would use this for a Hugo Boss Togs versus a synthesizer. My eternal devotion, love, and merry Yule, Angerad. Well, thank you very much, Angerad. That's very kind of you, and I'm glad you've enjoyed Millennial. Okay, here's another question for James. LARP with me, fam. If the magical pro-white billionaire were to appear, what specific job or tasks within the pro-white umbrella would each of you like to do, if anything? I think I'd probably want to coordinate digital messaging. What about you, James?
I've thought about this, actually, not in this specific context, but like in a different life, in a different world, in a world where we were actually in control of society, what ideal role would I have? I would like to work, I think, in some kind of ministry of family or something, and helping people to, I don't know. I think that getting married and having children has been the best thing that's happened to me. And so helping create policies at a national level, and this is assuming that we were in power, right? Helping create pro-family policies that allow people to not only to be able to start and have large families, but also to educate them and to prepare them for life, prepare them for successful participation in a culture. I think something like that would be the most rewarding for me.
Yeah. I think for me, actually, when I said digital messaging, I think a better thing would be fiction, like being in charge of drama, something like that. Like if the BBC, I went into this, if the BBC were to survive, I would like to be in charge of that. Like just saying, okay, here's what we're going to do this year and you know, how to create a healthy, just a nice culture again.
Could you get rid of the people that have hosting Top Gear and bring back some actual good hosts?
Of course.
Definitely. Actually, I amend my answer. That's what I want to do. If we had achieved total victory, I would love to host the new iteration of Top Gear.
Excellent. I think you'd be really good at it. Okay, someone says, this is Daniel. Hi, guys. Greetings from one of those horrible Poles living in Britain. Here's a little donation for that Hydrosynth you talked about. That is the synth I've got my eye on, the Hydrosynth. Personally, I prefer analog synths, but to each their own, I guess. Glad you're finally back, Wozie. And remember, things will be better. We will plough through this. Well, thank you very much, Daniel, for the well wishes and also for the donation. I do like analog synths as well, but my heart belongs to the digital realm because it's just more sort of varied. It's more interesting. And yeah, but I do love, I mean, of course, everyone, every sane person likes analog synths and the sound of them, the classic sounds from the 70s and all that. So, of course. But yes, thank you very much for that. There's one more question, which I think is a nice one to end on. Is concentrating on your own existence a positive alternative to politics, or an admission that the political battle is lost and your own existence is the only thing you can control? What would you say to that, James?
Well, that's actually a very good question. I think that there is people, and I find myself doing this, and it's a natural instinct, to want to hold out hope that there is something that can be done electorally, that maybe there will be some kind of inflection point where all of us as individuals can recognize the problems of our societies, the conquest by elites of the West, the conquest of neoliberalism, and right the ship. And I would like that to be the case, and I would like there to be a viable way to do that. And I think one way that could be done, for example, in the United States, would be if we had a multi-party system like European countries have, where you can actually field a political party that has its own ideology, and you don't have to work within the confines of either one of the two major parties. And that could be a way that you could gauge popular support and convince people and in fact, win elections and have representation in government. And so what I'm saying about electoral participation maybe is not applicable to all European countries because of that factor. I don't think admission, the word admission carries with it a context that you're resigned or that there's some kind of defeatist element of it, perhaps. But I don't disagree with that assertion, actually. I think we need to admit the truth. And if the truth is that electoral participation is not viable for us, or is at least, at the very least, not the best path forward, then there's no shame in that. In fact, there would be shame in deluding ourselves that pursuing some strategy that we know to be flawed, if we convinced ourselves and convinced others of doing that, in fact, we would be doing a disservice and we would be doing more harm than good. So he's not wrong by saying that. But at the same time, I want to be very careful and not give credence to the idea that we should retreat within ourselves and place our own comfort and our own personal well-being above all else. I think there are sacrifices that all of us can, financial sacrifices, what have you, that all of us can make for the betterment of our community. And community is overused a lot, but people have various overlapping communities, right? We're a part of a community. These listeners, everybody watching today is part of a community. But we also have the communities that are our family, the communities that are local to us, church communities or religious communities or other networks of which you're a part. And I think being an active member in those, regardless of which communities you choose, and working for the betterment of them, working to forward our sense of morality within those communities and within our families is a very worthwhile pursuit. But we shouldn't turn to completely inward. And I guess this is a positive note on which to end, is that we're not going to win or to achieve victory if we just eschew the outside world and say, I want to become, you know, the strongest, most fit, most wealthy person I can, and just insulate myself from all the problems of our society by you know, building myself up. Because, like I said earlier, this is not going to be a fight probably that we win within our youth, within our lifetimes, maybe even within our children's lifetimes. And we owe it to the next generation. We owe it to the children of our friends, the children of our brothers and sisters in this thing, to build ourselves and build our families to be stronger going forward. And that includes setting ourselves up financially to be as self-sufficient as we can, but also to be morally strong, to be morally right, and instilling good values in our children so that they can carry on what we're doing today. and to not let themselves fall victim to the pressures of the outside world that would absolutely love to turn them against themselves, would love to destroy their spirit, would love to crush them under its weight. So, yes, I think looking after ourselves and our families is a very worthwhile pursuit.
Yeah, and I agree. I also, well, I'll answer the question my own way as well. Is concentrating on your own existence a positive alternative to politics, or an admission that the political battle is lost and your own existence is the only thing?
Okay, I sort of misread that. So yes, I would say that it is. Well, it is positive.
Oh, yeah. I think that, well, your own existence is the only thing you can control. That's a fact. But as for whether the political battle is lost, it's never mm-hmm. really lost. I mean, things just keep going. It's often surprising how things do just keep going, even after you thought, okay, that's going to be it. But no, there's another chapter and another chapter and another, and it keeps evolving. What I would say about concentrating on your own existence, I think you've got to look at the inverse of that. I think there are people who, a lot of people in the movement, concentrate on the political stuff precisely because they're afraid of getting their own lives in order, including high profile people, myself in some ways, but other people too. I think that in some senses, to concentrate solely on politics and to be obsessed with politics is a refuge from getting your own house in order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't be concerned with politics or the state of the world in general. And I'm just saying, often it's an attempt to avoid things that are closer to home. Now, if you do address those things that are closer to home and to maximize control over your own life, your own existence, and build the life that you want to have, then you will be in a better position anyway to influence the political arena, to influence the people around you, because you're setting a good example. You're obviously a person who's sorted out and so on. So I think that should be the first step for everyone anyway. Maybe it's ironic coming from someone like me, but it's a realization that I've arrived at, mm-hmm. that I think that part of it is you shouldn't be, see, I try not to preach to people, ironically, because I'm aware of my own failings and so on. And so when I do speak about anything, really, I try to make it clear the position that I'm speaking from and my own level of experience about this and personality biases that might come into play and so on. But I think basically, yeah, I think it's better to, I think everyone should try to maximize their own control over their own lives. Then you'll be in a better position to influence things anyway.
Right.
And I think everyone admires and respects someone who lives, who sets a good example, rather than who preaches about how everyone else should live and what everyone else should think and what everyone else should believe and how everyone else should vote and so on. However, having said all of that, I also think we should be realistic about the goals that we set ourselves in terms of changing the world, because otherwise you are just setting yourself up for failure and everyone else around you, including the people who listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think change is not impossible in the world. Of course it isn't. We all have agency, and you know, the people we're up against are not all powerful overlords with the power of life and death and the power to control people's thoughts from remotely or whatever. Anything is still possible and will always remain possible.
Yes.
But we have to be very intelligent about the ways that we approach this.
Yes.
And that might mean, as James has said, setting in motion things that might not reach fruition even within our lifetimes, even within our children's lifetimes. But what we can certainly do is try to build very solid, robust and flexible foundations here and now for a movement that will almost certainly outlast our lifetimes. So that's what I would say. We just need to be sensible and realistic about all of this.
Yeah, that's very well said. And it's important to remember, too, that we all have a finite amount of energy, and that none of us are going to be the leader that brings us all to the victory at the top of the hill and, you know, hoist the flag and you know, we've won in this sort of spiritual battle. I think we all have roles to play, and we can all exert the most amount of influence by setting realistic goals. And whether this is to be the best father that you can be, whether it is to be a leader in your kids' scouting group, or in your church, or in some kind of interest group, or in a business group, or within your company, if you're working for some kind of corporation, then these are all positions from which you can actually do concrete things for people, and concrete things to better other people's lives, and to act as a bulwark against the wheels of the machine. For example, if you're a leader in your children's scouting group, you can make decisions about LGBT type of lessons or racial lessons or what have you. If you are in a position of influence in a company, you can make hiring and firing decisions. And of course, there are rules and regulations you'll have to abide by. But holding these positions of power and influence, they're very important. And what you said earlier is so true, that it's very easy to just sit on the sidelines, to retreat to the basement, and to tell everyone else how the world should be. But people like that don't shape the world. The people that are sitting on the sidelines and are checked out of the world don't have any influence over it. So in order to exert these changes, yes, we need to first better ourselves to be people who others will turn to and look to as leaders, and then to use the leadership opportunities we're able to procure in meaningful ways that can benefit people. And I'll just be honest, the leadership role that you achieve within your local political party is not going to be helpful to people, because you will constantly be under the microscope, and you will be forced to toe a line where you compromise yourself and you compromise your values, just like doing some kind of political commentary where you've convinced yourself that someday we'll reach the critical mass and everyone will be red-pilled all at once. You're convinced that you, by sneaking and by lying and by hiding what you believe, by what you believe, you'll win. You won't. So a leadership position, I think, like in your son's Boy Scouts organization or in a business network or within your company, will provide you with so many more opportunities to do meaningful things for people and to help in this struggle in which we all find ourselves.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you very much. I'll just go through the D-Live things. Angrad Celtic donated a diamond and said, MW and Allsup, heaven. Thank you very much, Angrad. Danish Warrior said, early Happy New Year, Woz and James. Thank you. Angrad donated a diamond and said something that I'm not going to say on air. Mel Gibson's uncle said, everyone needs to listen to James on Fash the Nation. Okay, Space Drone said, you're guiding light in a sea of degeneracy, James.
Well, very nice. Thank you.
Okay, Travis Hammer asks, Woz, will you ask James what he... let's not get into that now. I'm not going to broach that topic now. It's too late on. Disinfected donated diamond. Thank you. So did Bluten Biden. I'd like to congratulate Jazz Hands on being a dad. Okay, I hadn't heard of that. All right. And Carlo Danger donated a Ninjagini and said, I look forward to Millennial every year. I'm a proud TRS paycock as well. You all keep us normal people sane.
Excellent. Well, thank you.
Okay. And he donated another Ninjagini and said, also put this towards the the Udo Super 6 synth. Find me on Instagram to share music. Yeah, okay, the Udo Super 6 is very impressive, but I've got my heart set in the Hydra synth. But anyway, I hope you enjoy the Udo. Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, everyone. And I guess that's it for Millennial 2020. So I think it's been pretty successful. Everyone seems to have enjoyed it. Thanks for sticking by me. I think it's been 52 streams or something like that.
Wow.
So it's been a lot, and honestly, I'm a bit annoyed that it's over, because I'd like to just, I'm in the rhythm of it now, so I could just keep going. But yeah, it is something that's got to be reserved for once a year, a special time each year. So thank you to everyone for watching. I'm glad you've enjoyed it. I tried to make it quite varied this year, so I hope that came through. I hope next year's even more varied in terms of the people who speak. The guests that I have on. Yes. Okay. I think I'll just leave it there because there's not much left to say except thank you, thank you, thank you. So, all right. So thanks to all my guests as well, and to James for appearing this year. So excellent. All right. We'll leave it there. James Alsop, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2020.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. All right. In the meantime, I won't see you, well, tomorrow night I'm on Frodi's New Year's Eve thing, but I won't see you on Millennial until a year from now. So hope you all look forward to that. In the meantime, thank you for watching Millennial 2020. Bye for now.